Happy Mother's Day. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Later in the show, we're taking a trip yet again to Trump Twilight Zone, but we begin tonight's show with a conversation on the 8th Annual Workers Unite Film Festival, which is taking place right now. It started on May 10th, and it's running through the 23rd of May with the festival's Executive Director Andrew Tilson is with us in the studio. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Nice to be here. Thank you.
This is the 8th Annual Workers Unite Film Festival.
That amazes me. We're still here for 8 years, but we are. We keep growing thanks to our friends throughout the labor movement, supporters, friends, sponsors. So we're here, and we've been able to keep the festival going, enlarge it, increase the quality of the offerings. And this year we have about 60 films, over 32 programs, and we even have
I'm looking at a brochure that's 100 pages long. That's
100 pages long, can you believe it? We have so many movies, and we try and have a wide angle on this to talk about working people's lives and why they should be organizing if they're not organized, what they're doing to save their unions if they are organized and under attack, as many are.
Let's take a step back. Uh-huh. How did this come about? How did the Workers Unite Film Festival
become? I came out of doing, strangely enough, music videos, documentary production, things like that. And then I ended up at a certain point working with the Taxi Workers Alliance, filming a documentary about their whole story. At the same time that the Murphy Institute, which is now the School of Labor, started, and I ended up getting my master's there with a bunch of wonderful professors and teachers and students, and thought, New York City, we don't have a labor film festival. What's going on? It's one of the big labor strongholds. So we started a weekend event uptown at a theater near Columbus Circle. We sold out, for better or worse, and that got us going. So 8 years later, we're here for like 2 weeks, and it's been quite a trip.
And who's making films about labor?
The wonderful thing is that there's a wide variety of people. Everything, this year we're screening a film that many of you know called Sorry to Bother You, which is Boots Riley, which is the only recent labor bigger budget indie film out of Hollywood that has a strike in it and organizing for a strike. It takes a strange turn, but we'll leave that. For those who haven't seen it, they should come see it. But everybody from students, literally organizers, to professional filmmakers, it runs the gamut. And one of our big efforts, we're not just a film festival where you go sit and you watch a movie. Our goal is to train the next generation of activist filmmakers. We have an activist filmmakers boot camp during the festival designed to bring people from being just organizers to actually being able to tell a story on film and get it out there. And we've been successful in that. We actually have a guy named Victorious Da Costa who came to us with a 4-minute film several years ago, who now will have this next season, a new documentary directed by a guy named Muta Ali, who's Ruby Dee's grandson, I believe, about Yusef Hawkins' story called Storm Over Brooklyn. And so that's one of the things, the key parts to us is showing the films, putting them in the pipeline to be seen everywhere, and then training people to make the next generation.
You know, in the past 10 years, we talk about this on this show, about the change in public perception on labor in the past 10 years. In 2009, public opinion was at 42% for labor. It's now at 62%, according to recent polls. And part of that has got to be, in my opinion, the movement into the culture, moving culture along. We've talked about how music played such a big role in the labor movement in the early 20th century, the mid-20th century. Film now can be a huge way of just explaining labor to the world.
I mean, we obviously feel very strongly that you can convince and change the hearts and minds of people much more quickly with even a short video than you can with 10 books on the subject, because we're just not reading. Our attention spans, for better or worse, are shorter. And we got to reach people where they are. You know, we're not going to drag them to a point where they're not. And at the end of the day, if we can reach them with a 5-10 minute film or an hour and a half film, we've seen it happen. We were discussing earlier that I teach electricians and plumbers. Many of them were not on the progressive side of the spectrum in the last election. But as they've gone through seeing some of these films, it's opened their eyes entirely. We have a film playing late at night on Mother's Day after you've had your dinner.
get down there now. Where
get
are people going? By the way, where are people going? To
Cinema Village. Cinema Village is our home base. Thanks to Cinema Village for being our home base for the last several years. And then we scoot around town. DC 1707 is hosting us a couple of nights. The Public Employees Federation is hosting us on a couple of nights. Park Church Co-op music film event on May 22nd.
I just interrupted you. Go back to the film that's showing later this
evening. Lieutenant Van Dorn. Who killed Lieutenant Van Dorn? You never think of service people in our military as workers, but they are workers. And there was just a story, I believe, yesterday on the news about how where they're living, once it was privatized by our friends in the Republican Party, they basically put them in poverty-level living spaces.
Military folks?
Military folks. The story just came out in the last 24, 36 hours. So it's no surprise that these guys, this 132 service people, have been killed in non-combat crashes of what's called the Seahawk helicopter, which is the double rotor, the workhorse of the Navy and the Marines. And the Navy and Marine brass know about this. They kind of use the crashes as a way to ask for the billions more for the new weapons, but they don't fix, they don't do any even routine maintenance enough on these Seahawk helicopters. And so these guys who really join honorably to serve the country, their lives are completely put at risk in the prime of their lives with young kids and all of that. And it's a stunning movie, Who Killed Lieutenant Van Dorn?
We're talking with the Workers Unite Film Festival Executive Director Andrew Tilson. The 8th Annual Workers Unite Film Festival is taking place May 10th through the 23rd here in New York City. This other films that you want to perhaps tell us to come out and see?
Well, definitely. I mean, early, we have quite a lot. We have a film, a film about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire Memorial, important, playing throughout the festival. We have several films about what's happening with the idea of being kind of a young, non-white person in New York City struggling to make your way and getting really a lot of negative attention from the police, unfortunately, when it's not deserved. We have several films. Trouble Finds You. We have El Grito de Sunset Park has made a few films. Cop Watch. They're going to be playing on Monday night. And then we have Thursday night on Thursday night, May 16th. We have a whole evening about what just happened yesterday, the strike, about Uberland, about the fact that you could have this initial public offering where these five or six guys make billions of dollars, and yet the drivers are killing themselves because they can't.
The Uber drivers.
The Uber drivers, the for-hire drivers. And so we have several films that night, and it's actually in partnership with the IDG, the Drivers Guild, which has organized a lot of these drivers, and hopefully the Taxi Workers Alliance folks, because we have a film called Run the Meter about the destruction of the yellow cab industry, basically.
Have you got a sense that the technology that makes it possible to produce films, people making films on their handheld these days, that has increased the amount of content that you're coming across as
Absolutely.
You're making choices?
Absolutely. I mean, everybody has a 1080p, has a high-def camera in their pocket that records pretty good audio also. And we use that as a basis. We get lots of films, by the way. A lot of smaller doc films are shot on phones now. But we use that as a basis to train. We have a training program together with the Van Arsdale Institute,
right,
out of Empire, where we train electricians and plumbers to shoot 5-6 minute films about their working lives, their union lives. We're in the fourth term. It's been stunning. And talk about winning hearts and minds. People who don't think about these questions when they actually are forced to make a movie about their own situation, it really crystallizes for them the inequity sometimes and the value of having a union where they might not have thought about it before.
And you're seeing new faces. You're seeing new folks who are either coming to the movement or interested in making films. And how do they jibe? We've got about 2 minutes left. How do they jibe both their interests and their activism with their art?
It's a great question because we feel very strongly that we come from many years, probably decades of working in the labor progressive movement. What we see when we target actually is people in their 20s and 30s to get to these movies, to make these movies, because they're the voice of the next generation. We see a lot of, I would say 75% of our ticket buying is from people under 35, interestingly.
Wow.
And that's how we program. So we know, you know, we're trying to open it up. And because not every movie is about like organizing a strike, because A, it's not that exciting to watch. Although we have a stunning movie called Union Time on May 21st at Workers United headquarters. That's about the 16-year battle successful to organize the North Carolina Smithfield meat plant. Stunning, amazing movie. Definitely come.
May 21st
at Workers United. It's on the schedule. But we have lots of young people who see, I think in the younger population, I think the numbers were like 70%, right? That thought
right.
that unions were necessary. They
right.
would want a union if they could have one. And that's what we see. So we're really trying to bridge that gap where being in the labor movement, being an organizer, being involved in worker issues is something that's cool, that is positive and progressive.
We're talking with Andrew Tilson. He's the executive director of the Workers Unite Film Festival, now in its eighth year. From May 10th through the 23rd of May, the question I have, let's do this very quickly. How do we get more information? Someone right now wants to find out everything there is to know about the film festival. What are they doing?
They go to www.workersunitefilmfestival.org and they look at the schedule, and there are links right there for Eventbrite to buy tickets. They can also go to Eventbrite directly and just search for Workers Unite Film Festival.
So do that again from the top.
So they can go to www.workersunitefilmfestival.org, and they can click on the schedule for 2019. It brings up Eventbrite, which is where they can buy tickets. They can also go to Eventbrite directly and click on Workers Unite Film Festival.
Andrew Tilson, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck with the festival.
Thanks a lot for having me.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Thank you. We're back. Happy Mother's Day. It is Mother's Day, Sunday evening, May 12th. And my next guest is Dan Janison, because we're taking a trip back into Trump Twilight Zone. It was a crazy week. Welcome back to the show, Dan Janison of Newsday.
Thank you.
So the week began with a mutual friend of ours, Russ Buettner, and his colleagues at the New York Times coming up with a story that they took a look at 10 years of Trump taxes and found that the president of the United States apparently lost over $1 billion in the 10 years, somewhere in the 1980s and 90s, while he was promoting a book called The Art of the Deal and claiming to be one of the top, you know, businessmen in the world. What is it about? Now, we tend to break down Trump in a couple of ways. We do Trump, the policies, and what policies have been coming out for the last two years. And then we do Trump, the mythology, and this is under Trump, the mythology.
Right.
How is it that this fellow, and here in New York City, we always were sort of in on the joke. He was a big tabloid guy. He was kind of a folk hero. But we always knew it was a joke. The rest of the country wasn't in on it, were they?
Because of television, the miracle of television.
It's that simple.
The Apprentice, it built his reputation. I saw him on TV handle a situation and fire someone with determination and crispness.
It must be real.
It's all fake. But you know, in reality, TV isn't reality. But there's more to it. You promote a reputation, you present a reputation, people buy it. We were recalling the old John McCain went around telling everybody that he's a straight talker. So what happened? People in the press went around saying, "Oh, he's a straight talker." Why? He told me.
But not everyone can pull this off. Clearly, as you say, it helps to have a TV show that's on for 10 years, putting out a certain sense of what success looks like. But what was your take on the idea that while he was selling himself as the Prince of Wealth, he was losing all that money?
He was losing money because he's never been really all that strategic or all that good at making money. He inherited a lot and played off that. He even inherited his father's brain trust, if you will. I mean, the whole Roy Cohn thing is something that developed because Cohn defended the father against charges of housing discrimination. It's a very interesting how this catches on. I'm convinced that a lot of his popularity, the people defend his government on the basis that that there were these great tax cuts. And if we believe in trickle down, then they're having a wonderful effect on the economy. That they want conservative judges because they're against abortion, or they don't want certain democratic priorities, and people like certainly the industries like the deregulation. But those are all Republican policies. What he does is takes what you would have had under Rubio or Cruz or even John Kasich, and he polishes them into something that is all his own.
And that's right. When you get past the bombastic personality, these are policies that are. Certainly in terms of labor protections, he's his Department of Labor is doing terrible things to the rights of workers. His education department is doing terrible things to public education, or is trying to do terrible things to public education. So this is not a – here's a guy coming from New York City who is representing some of the most regressive conservative policies, which from my mind makes him anti-New York. I mean, just makes him – it's like he never came from New York City.
Well, if you disagree with you know, obviously would, you know, if you disagree with having weak labor enforcement or weak enforcement of union rights, if you favor that sort of thing, or you know, any of these other policies, they're not. They're sort of. What's interesting is those are sort of passive things. Those are things he's not doing.
Right. Right.
And it's hard to convince people that the president is a passive player, which he is. He's probably best off. You know, his best sales pitches are for what he's not doing. He's not getting us involved in Iraq or Vietnam. You know,
right.
He's not imposing certain things that we wouldn't want. You know, it's. I think when the history of the administration gets written, it will be about things he did not do that he was popular for not doing.
And for which we will all take a sigh of relief that he did not do, right? I mean,
possibly, you know, there's no wall.
Well, let's get back for a minute to this mythology. One thing I had always given him credit for, because those of us who have been in New York for a long time remember that at some point in time, I believe in the 80s, the city was, for whatever reason, unable to fix Woolman Rink in Central Park, and what I believe catapulted him to fame and glory was his ability to fix that ice skating rink. Well, I gave him that on social media the other day, and a friend of mine who I've known since we were both teenagers said he didn't build that rink. My dad built that rink. And there was a guy named Artie Nussbaum who ran a construction company for many years who apparently Trump convinced to help him do this. So I've been giving him credit for the rink. He doesn't even deserve credit for the rink, apparently.
Well, the way he did it, according to Michael D'Antonio in his book Never Enough, which was published before the election, he managed to delay the cost. You know, the big to do was that he did it at less cost than the city could do it. The way he did that was he got construction people from other projects of his to basically lowball everything on the promise that they would, you know, they would make it up later. It's an interesting way of making yourself look good.
But it was all hype. I mean, this fellow who worked on this and who actually solved the problem said he was enticed by the fact that Trump said, we're both going to be heroes. We're going to get up on the podium and we're going to announce to the world we fixed this thing. Well, there was no we. Trump got on the podium.
Oh, there's never a we.
there's no room for a second guy at the podium.
Yeah. Also, you know, like, There are a lot of issues where he'll become famous for things that others, you know, he basically is a buyer. He bought certain ideas. The charge against MS-13, which is, you know, beautiful for the anti-immigrant people because
the gang,
you know,
the gang MS-13,
the worst bastards on earth,
right?
You know, that concern was developed and sort of thought out by John Kelly. He was commander of Central American forces. And, you know, you would never know it right. from the president, who made up the threat and everything else. But he put the show around it.
And that became a diversion from whatever really needed to be going on at the time.
Sure.
Let me ask you, and this is May of 2019, and we're talking about the presidential campaign, which seems to me as if it's going to be interminable. The last one seemed to me to go on forever.
Right.
Do you think it makes any sense whatsoever to be doing analysis of how the candidates are doing at this stage of the game?
No. But how do you avoid looking at what they're doing?
But the horse race.
And how do you keep up on what 20 people are doing?
But the horse race doesn't make any sense right now, because right. there is a lifetime between now and the election.
Absolutely.
There are many lifetimes between now and the election. Yet we keep. I guess I'm just beating up on you because you're the man writing this stuff.
You're
one of the guys writing this stuff. What value do you think there is, and I don't mean to be discrediting it, but the horse race part of this, as opposed
right.
to telling us what these people think, the idea that there are polls that put Biden so far ahead, do you think that that's a meaningful poll at this stage?
No. Nor is the only thing that I can posit is that Trump goes into re-election as a favorite because presidents usually get re-elected.
Right, and right, absolutely.
And when they don't get re-elected, it's the case, like with Carter and Bush Sr., that their parties were very ambivalent about them. Trump doesn't have that problem. He has locked up the party.
I want to cut.
Bill Weld isn't going to cut into that.
We've got about 1 minute left, mm-hmm. and I wanted to acknowledge the death of Larry Hanley, who was mm-hmm. the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. And Tom Robbins wrote that he was the true dignity of labor, with a wise crack and a clever gimmick to make a point. In about 45 seconds, this is a terrible misjustice, but tell us about Larry Hanley.
The best thing I can bring to the table is this. I knew him when I was covering transit on Staten Island long, long ago, and he was a union dissident who was trying to create a populist uprising against the powers that be in Local 726, and he very much succeeded, and he did it in a very savvy way.
Larry Hanley was the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. He died this week at the age of 61. He was a bus driver and a union leader, and we're going to miss him. That's just about all the time we've got. Sorry, Dan. Got to cut this conversation off.
No,
Dan,
thank you.
Dan Janison of Newsday. Always a pleasure to have you on and to share the time with you as we go deep into Trump Twilight Zone.
Thank you.
That's all the time we've got. Just a couple of announcements. The DC 37 Ed Fund is holding a college fair on Thursday, May 16th at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. To RSVP, please visit www.dc37.net. I'm Chris Policano. The producer is Rudy Orozco. Andrea Minocchio is the engineer. Until next time, ciao.